Thank you for the amazing response. I like that idea of the energy bills, Sharon, very much. you know, what you were just saying about, you know, that it is, it's a lot simpler than it's made out to be, I think is a really crucial idea, because there's something that's been happening, and I've seen in all of the disaster zones, and I know that the people from India have experienced this as well, where there's part of the disaster capitalism complex is a, you know, are the psychiatrists and psychologists who descend on conflict zones and disaster zones, and a lot of them, you know, obviously people are just there to help, but a lot of the language is really pathologizing the people who have lived through this traumatic event, and people are labeled as damaged, right? And the labeling of people as damaged, as traumatized. I remember when I was in Sri Lanka, we were looking at what was going on there with very similar things to what's happening in India with the seizing of the whole coastline, the displacing of hundreds of thousands of people, the small boat fishing people were the people who were victimized by the tsunami. They were between 80 and 90% of the people who were displaced. In some places, they were 98%, because this is who lives on the coast. And the government said that they were too afraid to move back to their homes. And they used you know, really dodgy survey that had been conducted where they said, you know, are you afraid of another tsunami? And everyone said yes. And then that was used against the people to say, okay, well, we're going to move you inland and give the coast to people who work in hotels. And I was there working with a wonderful activist named Kumari. She just goes by one name. And we would be interviewing people, and they would start using the language that had been used on them. So we would say, how are you? And they would go, I'm traumatized. And Kumari would get so angry, she would go, no, you're sad. Say you're sad. you lost a lot, so be sad. But once you start using the language of trauma, then you're damaged, so you can't participate in your reconstruction. Then it becomes okay to make decisions without you because you're damaged. Damaged people don't get to be part of decision-making, so it becomes a weapon. And I think we have to be, I don't think it's deliberate, but it's quite potent. So this idea that actually it's simple, but more than that, it's healing. That the experience of living through a traumatic event, what binds all of us who've lived through it is, and I haven't lived through it, you know, on this scale, but because I'm, you know, writing about this stuff, I've been, you know, been to Iraq, I've been in bombings, and, you know, it is a feeling of total powerlessness. Right? It's the feeling of something horrible is happening and you can't help. You can't save your loved ones. You're watching people die and you can't help. And you know, that's when people go into shock. So it turns out that the best cure for helplessness is helping, not being told how helpless you are over and over again. And I remember that, you know, in the shelters in Baton Rouge, in the huge convention center, meeting people going, why are we being locked up here? That's the way it felt. You know, not that they were being housed and sheltered, but with all the guards and the checkpoints and the security, that actually felt like a jail. And, you know, and we were meeting all of these people saying, you know, I'm strong. You know, we can rebuild. We can help. Why are we being kept here? Why are we being pathologized? So thank you for making that point, Sharon. I think it's absolutely key and very, very political in this moment. You know, Peter mentioned, you know, this idea, you know, this alternative narrative that I'm trying to tell about our history, and maybe it's, you know, it's a bit much to sort of tell this alternative story of the past 35 years, and, you know, and I'm sure it is, but I'll tell you what sort of motivates me to retell this history a little differently. Not that it's a definitive account, but it's another one. Is that I think what happens, another thing that happens in what creates trauma. What makes us disoriented and vulnerable to people who want to take advantage of us in moments of trauma is we lose our narrative, we lose our story, we lose our space in time. You know, I remember that feeling of vertigo after September 11th. I had to give a speech a few days later, and I remember standing up at the podium feeling like the earth was moving beneath me, and I just didn't know what to say, right? And I forget who it was, and I've looked really hard to try to match this quote. It's not mine. But it was that September 11th was an event without a story. that it was just pure event, you know, roaming around, this pure event. And what disoriented us in that moment was that we didn't have a narrative, we didn't have anything to make sense of it yet. And what we did have was the Bush administration saying, everything you knew before doesn't count. History has been rebooted. Everything that you thought you knew is pre-September 11th thinking. So they were continuing that state of vertigo and purposefully making us feel like we didn't know anything and we were childlike and we just had to listen to the experts who had figured it all out and it was a clash of civilizations and we were now going to go to war for all time against evil. But that's why I think that, you know, no matter what the alternative story is, stories matter. You know, stories matter, the stories that we tell each other matter. Things that root us and give us something to hold on to are a form of shock resistance. Because when we share our stories, when we understand these tactics, we are a lot harder to exploit. You know, coming back to this idea in the manuals of keeping people separate, witnessing this wonderful exchange over the past few days, you know, this is counter-shock tactics of people saying, okay, this is how this system works where I live. This is how it works where I live. This is what they tried to do to us. This is how they tried to do it here. And it's really like the prisoners, you know, passing each other notes between the bars, going, this is what they're going to do to you, okay? So prepare yourself. It works. And that's why it's so powerful. It's why it's dangerous. It's why we have to build these networks ourselves. No one's going to build them for us. Ahmad talked about when the state fails and not, you know, romanticizing NGOs and I think part of what he's saying is, you know, don't let the state off so easily. Don't write the state off, you know, because just because they failed us, it doesn't mean we should just say, okay, you're off the hook. We're going to build our own. We're going to do it ourselves. And I think that, but if we think about what Sharon said, we want something in between, really. We want to participate. We don't want to abdicate to the state, but we want a state that is responsive to us. So I don't think that we need to pit these ideas against each other. I think that they're absolutely, we want to remake the state, so that is us, in a way, right? We don't want to just, the state that was able to abandon people is not the same state that will be able to save us. But neither can we write it off. And I think that, you know, the stakes of this are very high. People have different feelings about this, but one of the things that I've seen in disaster zones is when the state fails, there are a few different forces that fill that vacuum. One of them are NGOs. I'm not talking about wonderful NGOs like ActionAid. Who do work with local communities on principles of participation and accountability, but an industry of NGOs that basically say, we have figured out what you need, you know, and it's kind of, and we're going to take pictures of us giving it to you and go home and raise them with pictures. It's a privatized state without the ability to hold those NGOs in any way accountable for the money that is actually the money that was raised in the name of the people. That, you know, it's not a gift. But NGOs are just a conduit, you know, but they've gotten, you know, they're involved in brand wars with each other in order to keep raising the money. So they lose sight of the fact that they really are just a conduit of people in one part of the world wanting to help people in another part of the world. That money wasn't given to Red Cross or Oxfam because we think they're great. It's because we wanted, actually, we didn't know another way to help, right? So they were a conduit, and I think we need to insist that they act more like conduits and less like multinational corporations. But the other force that fills that vacuum is religion, often religious fundamentalism, and I think that's true. You know, I saw it in Iraq. I was there when a period where Muqtada al-Sadr was becoming very, very popular, and it was because the U.S. Reconstruction was such a complete failure that Sadr was organizing a grassroots reconstruction in places like Sadr City, which was, you know, everything, you know, from bringing up electricity, water, garbage collection, traffic, and security, and that's where the Mahdi army was born. So this, you know, when the state advocates, that is a byproduct. That is something that happened, And in this country, I think we see a different but very similar manifestation of it in communities where the only public space or pseudo public space is a kind of a mega church, right? Which is, you know, there is no town square, there is no space, and these often become tools for the Republican Party, and the loss of the public sphere, the erosion of public space in this country, I think, is very intimately connected to a rise of a very reactionary form of Christianity in this country as well. So I think I'm going to open it up and hope that. Should I moderate this floor or is it?
Either way.
I think you should.
We'll start with Aaron on our way. Let's take one from each section.
Thank you very much for coming back to the room and revisit this and tell me for this. I was just thinking that when you were talking about pathologies and how certain pathologies are then given to certain groups of people, and a lot of times there's like a pathology of time. And that's sort of like put on people of color, black people, especially women. And how you said at the Superdome, at the Astrodome, how it felt like a jail. Because it was a jail, right? I mean, they did lock people up, and there was constant criminalization of people as far as how they were making sure that people don't come back. And I was wondering if when you talk about disaster capitalism, how the free labor that comes out of the prison and the police force happening, how that feeds into that happening in the city. Because in one way or the other, the criminalization makes sure and ensure that it's a blank slate, ensure that it maintains black and blank and white, and people don't come back, which is a tool of genocide. But then it's also how the money that comes out of that, how much money that goes into that from the state. Well, let's talk about that. And I was wondering if you could go ahead.
Part of this, what I would broadly describe as this disaster capitalism complex, that incarceration in the same way of the explosion of private security, private jails, and prison labor is all part of the business of different kinds of disaster, whether disaster creation, disaster response, reconstruction from disaster. I mean, it's just a ballooning industry. I've only started to read a little bit about the use of prison labor in the rebuilding of the city, so I'm not an expert on it. I don't have anything on it on the book. What I do have something in the book is the thought about slave labor that is being practiced with immigrant people in the city who are brought in and not paid and are having contractors call me or being told that the INS is coming in the middle of the night. And this is an absolutely extraordinary form of modern slavery. And I thought when I was here 2 years ago, the anticipation of it when I was interviewing people in the legislature from Louisiana Development. It's a private sector development wing. And so I was
the Louisiana Redevelopment Authority?
Yes. And even at that time, I mean, just 10 days after the levees broke, I was asking about why the people in the shelters couldn't do the work of reconstruction. And these are the people that were saying, I want to work. And they were already saying, well, maybe it's not going to be rebuilt by the same people. And they were talking about, here in the South, we have a migrant workforce moves from one large scale project to the next. And, it was already clear that was the plan, which is insane. So I do talk about that. Unfortunately, there's a delay with these books where, I finished it 6 months ago and it takes that long to get it out. And I have only just recently heard of it. So, it sounds like it's an area where there needs to be some good analysis.
I'm a Katrina survivor who refused to evacuate. I live on this side where they gave the mandatory order by force to leave the East Bank. I was here when you were in the car wreck. I was in the corridor, but it was a police state. We were all That's something I experienced firsthand. I had a gun put in my face that threatened to arrest me. I was threatened with arrest dozens and dozens of times once I had a gun pulled on me. But also, I was an academic. I'm a street entertainer. But I put together a dissertation on academic shock therapy in Argentina in 1975 when Isabel Perón was the president. And so I was caught in this situation of having to fight for my survival. But then as things loosened up, trying to make sense of what they were trying to impose on us, as a science major, that was something I was comfortable with. And I agree wholeheartedly with what you said, because about them taking Friedman's doctrine and putting it on, I came to something like that conclusion by about late October. The one thing that I don't think anybody's talked about, but maybe for future disasters, is how authorities use mandatory, in this case mandatory evacuation, as a tool to politically disempower people. Right? Part of the reason they could close down charity, part of the reason they could lock out folks in the projects, which I've been involved even before the storm, and part of the reason they could smash the teachers union was because nobody was here. Right? And they wouldn't let anybody come back, and then, of course, they did everything in their power to prevent people from returning. So in a way, when you talked about Pinochet, this was the mandatory evacuation as well as the crisis was kind of the force that was used against us to loosen up. And so they could just ram it through. In a way, they faced, there was no one here to defend public services. And that's what I've been about even before the storm, what I've been about since after. But there's some other issues that come up here too, when people are coming in to help the community, because I was in the community, even when we were in a lot of us here. One was the role of volunteer labor. All right, I remember right after the storm, if you were a survivor here, you know, violating the law right after, you could go get a job for $15 or $20. All right, that was just, I thought, well, yeah, one of the good things that are coming out of this is that people have a chance to make some money. For New Orleans, that's good money. But now we've had a situation where in the newspaper they mentioned that there's been 623 million hours worth of volunteer labor in New Orleans, and that amount of labor is increasing, not decreasing here, and it's becoming more skilled labor. And I'm thinking there needs to be a discussion among the NGOs about the impact that this has on our people, because that translates into thousands of jobs. Now, granted, the government shouldn't be doing it, and another struggle that we have in C3 and South Iberville have been doing with the people is trying to focus folks on political demands. But the reality is the whole thing's been privatized. And so I wonder if you have any insights on how we deal with, say, like if we're volunteers or just people in the streets dealing with NGOs, dealing with nonprofits, who in many ways are exploiting the situation and making the environment for our democratic rebuilding much more difficult.
I think that there needs to be a movement, not just here, to where the idea of charity, which this economy is, you know, so reliant on, precisely because the state has failed. You know, where the idea of charity, you know, is part of the state. That, you know, one of the first things Bush said was, you know, give to the Red Cross, and then a list of other religious charities that people should give to. This was his idea of disaster response, right? We don't ask very much of these charities, right? I mean, the only time you hear a scandal is more like an accounting scandal at Red Cross, but it isn't about the lack of accountability between the NGOs and the communities that they're serving. And it's a privilege to have raised billions of dollars in the name of Katrina survivors. It's a responsibility. It should come with all kinds of requirements. And I think that it really is up to the communities to make those demands. And you know, I think that you know, there were all kinds of initiatives to do that. It was very hard to get media attention for them. It was very hard to get the attention of the NGOs. And that's why I actually think there need to be alliances between the people who do the giving and the people who are receiving the funds. The people who give the money to the NGOs need to make need to attach strings to the money and only give to NGOs that are certified as democratic by the community. I mean, I think this is very, very sketchy, but I think these are core issues. The issues around volunteer versus non-volunteer labor, it comes up again and again. The other way, too. I mean, it also comes up, I heard it in Sri Lanka from the opposite perspective, that there was lots of volunteer labor to rebuild. And then the NGOs came in and started paying people, and suddenly there was no more volunteer labor because what was happening on a volunteer basis was suddenly commodified. So I don't think there is a right way, wrong way, but the right way is the accountable, democratic way. And so the issue is that the communities have to decide which they want, and there is no mechanism for that decision to take place. So I guess I'm just saying, if this is going to be now a huge part of our economy, that this is how we're responding to disasters is through charity, then charity has to be accountable. We're living in a time where, Jeffrey Sachs stands up and said, we don't need governments, to have aid budgets anymore. The top 100, or top how many billionaires did he say? Top 40 billionaires could replace the aid budgets of governments. And this was not a joke. This was an actual suggestion. So I also think we should challenge the idea that, because what he's proposing is a kind of corporate world government of just, Bill Gates and just sort of noblesse oblige at the very top and dealing with, people living on a dollar a day. And so that's happening. That's the bigger picture context of this explosion of the charitable industry.
Thomas, and I'm a member of the International Longshore Warehouse Union Board. We do all, we handle all of the maritime cargo on the West Coast. We provided containers, construction supplies, as well as money from our rank and filers. But on the subject of language, Naomi, I was kind of curious why you did not use the term genocide. I came in a little late during your presentation, but I found it struck me because I've been to Baghdad myself. I was a part of a trade union delegation that went there in 2003. You made reference to the shock and awe on the general populace, and that was a form of genocide, just as the sanctions were during the Clinton administration. But as an African American and as a trade unionist, those of us on the West Coast that saw black folks and other people of color, as well as the poor, being left to fend on their own, that's a form of genocide. And you made reference to that with respect to Iraq, but I'm wondering why that didn't come up, because I think that people need to understand what genocide is, so that it is not something that they read in a book and think that it takes place in a third world country, because if you watch what happened on television, you would have thought New Orleans was a third world country. So I'd like you to respond just with respect to why genocide has not been a part of the presentation this evening, because in my book, that's exactly what it was.
I used the phrase in the book. I didn't use it at all in the speech. I didn't use it in relation to Iraq. Well, I talked about Chopin, but I don't think I used the word genocide there either. In the book, and that's because I think it takes a while for me to sort of lay out the framework for what I mean by genocide, which I'm happy to do. But I do make the argument in the book that this form of free market fundamentalism is actually inherently genocidal, and in fact is the most radical part of the argument that I'm making. And I sort of hesitate to do it in short form precisely because I don't want to be taken out of context. But the ideology is an ideological quest for purity, which is the markings of any of these genocidal projects throughout history. You have these recurring themes. That's why the quest for the clean sheet, the blank slate, it's an inherently genocidal idea. And what I was saying about blank is beautiful, that being at the core impulse of this project. It's a genocidal idea. It's about getting rid of people. It's about cleaning the slate. And if you read the core texts of Chicago School Economics and this capitalist counter-revolution against any of the ideas that had tried to moderate this extreme form of capitalism, it is a deeply fundamentalist mindset which believes in a pure form of capitalism, and sees any moderating forces, whether it's trade unions, whether it's any public institution whatsoever, whether it's a housing project, as a contamination. And this is where we start hearing more and more of this language, as a contamination of the perfect system, and the word economists use is a distortion. It's a market distortion. And so if there's a problem in this system, then you have to remove the distortion. And this entire, the whole history that I'm trying to track here is the attempt to stamp out those distortions and the people who stand for those distortions, the trade unionists, the people who dare to believe in a form of collectivism that stands in the way of this model. It was clearest in Latin America in the 70s, where several courts, for instance in Argentina, several courts have ruled that what happened there was a genocide against the left, where trade unionists, soup kitchen workers, psychologists, people involved in liberation theology were systematically targeted because they stood for ideas that were a threat to this ultra-competitive world. And I think that this is where the uprooting of people is so significant, because the greatest, obviously, it is deeply racist. But when you export one group of workers and import another group of workers, I think that the big threat that is being attacked here is the very idea of a rooted community. Deracinated workers who may be radical where, and rooted where they are from, but have been uprooted and forced to move, are much easier to control in a country where they don't speak the language, where they don't have communities of support around them. And the African-American community in this city is a notoriously organized, rooted network of people, which is precisely why it is so threatening to this vision of a purely money system. And so that impulse, the impulse for the clean sheet, the need to get rid of rooted people, whether it's along the coastlines in Sri Lanka, in India, in Thailand, whether it's in the export processing zones in the Philippines or China, where you have policies of not hiring the people from the local provinces. I heard this when I was researching No Logo, that in the largest export zones in the Philippines, they had a policy of not hiring the young women from the particular province. They would only hire women who had to travel hours and hours from their hometown. And I'd interview the bosses of these factories, and they would make generalizations. Well, people in the Cavite province are very stubborn, very happy. But it was that when people become migrants, the loss of those networks, makes them much easier to control. And wherever people are rooted, and wherever people have those networks, they are a threat to this project. And so I do use the phrase. I'm not afraid of the phrase. I think it's a phrase we have to be really careful with. We need to contextualize it and define it. I do think it has happened in this city. If we define genocide as a willful and planned removal of a group, an identifiable group of people, in whole or in part. That is the way it's defined in international law. It doesn't have to be a complete removal. It's in whole or in part, an identifiable group.
What you're describing is also a phenomenon.
as shocking as that is, that's exactly what they done. And then when I sat on a plane next to a woman who lived in Aspen at the time, and we had a conversation about this very same issue, she said, oh, we've been doing it in Aspen for years. So, you know, again, it's a trend. It's a very frightening trend, and you nailed it right on the head, you know, just in terms of that. So. And then one last thing was just the cultural efficiency, the fabulous book of Everyone Can Read by Ray Callahan, talks about in the 50s, I come from education, it talks about in the 50s the adaptation of the business model to our public school system, and it could be written today. I mean, this is exactly what's happening right now. So, in terms of the language.
Stand so people can hear, please.
Indigenous people of our country, the first peoples of our country, for the African Americans in this country. But we have not, there has not been a genuine process of truth and reconciliation in this country. And so there's a repetition again and again. The blindness returns again and again. You know, in Argentina, when we were there documenting this amazing process, everybody told us that whenever we would do interviews, you know, well, what's the significance of what's happening here? People would say, well, the dictatorship has just ended. And we had no idea what we were talking about. They were talking about, because it was 2002 and the dictatorship had ended in 1982. What they were saying was that they were coming out of fear and they were coming out of shock. But more than that, that they saw the dictatorship ending. Because when the economy collapsed and they had their terrible disaster and they were locked out of their bank accounts, there was looting all over the country, the president at the time, Fernando de la Rúa, went on television and declared a state of siege, which is exactly how the coup started in 1976. He went on television and he said, we are under siege now from enemies of the state, poor people, looting supermarkets for the enemies of the state. Stay in your house. He imposed a curfew. And mid-speech, while he was still telling people that a state of siege had been declared, you started to hear people banging pots and pans from the streets. And people just poured out of their houses. They defied the state of siege. They went to the main plaza, Plaza de Mayo, and stayed until the president had to escape in a helicopter. And then they overthrew four more presidents in the next 2 weeks. And so that moment was sort of relayed to us over and over again as we didn't let it happen again. And why? Because we know how it works. Because it has happened before, and this time we knew exactly what was happening. We knew that our fear and the disorder was being taken advantage of to consolidate state power, and that we could potentially say goodbye to all of our rights in that moment, and we rejected it collectively. Right? So there was tremendous pride in that. So both of those countries, and I think Germany is another example. Germany is, you know, one of the only countries that in its region that didn't accept economic shock therapy in the period, you know, during German reunification. It would have been the natural time for the shock therapist to come in and try to do this rapid fire shock therapy that was done in Russia, that was done in Poland. It wasn't done in Germany because people had gone through a process of understanding the danger of these shocks, understood it in their own history, understood that it could unleash forces, that it had unleashed forces of fascism in the past that they didn't want unleashed. So I really do think that the narrative that we keep to grapple with in our own country is deeper than the narrative, much deeper than the narrative that we've been talking about tonight. It's the deeper narrative of our own complicity and our own history, and that when we are truly rooted in time and space in our own history, then it's much harder to disorient us and to take advantage of us. So I hope that answers. You can contact me. Actually, we just started a website. My website, naomiklein.org. You can contact me. But we also have all the original source material for the books online. We're getting it out there.
Some people have been here for 4 hours, and I know some people are probably willing to be here for another 4 hours, but this is a privilege to be here with a person of such wisdom and insight and such ability to communicate. That isn't it a beautiful, beautiful gift that you have? And I would invite up to the mic for like 30-second things, people who want to announce some of the ways that New Orleans is resisting over the next several days so that you can hear about some of those things, but really try to do it very quickly so that as many people as possible can hear it. So thank you for coming, and whoever's closest to coming up, and I'll tap you on the shoulder when the 30 seconds is done.